Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are helping the good people get the good skills that they need to beat the bad people at the rhetoric game. That's the whole thing. Beat out the unethicals for all the rhetorical prizes. It's got to be complicated times out there, so it requires more sophisticated techniques. So I'm trying to hand some of those out here on the podcast. I'm Dr. Dan, late night comedy writer, PhD in rhetoric, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The podcast, I do three things. I talk to comedians about their politics, see what pinballs are bouncing around inside of those brains. I convert conservatives because I'm fascinated by the right, and I want to know how they think it fits in with the future of America. And I talk to persuasion pros about their experiences out there, trying to actually take something into the world and get it furthered, get it accepted. And that's kind of my guest today. I've known this guy for probably a year now. We met when he came and did a talk at my house on paleo uses. Like, he talked to a paleo group about his company that he is the CEO and co-founder of Blue Nest Beef. Fascinating little company with all sorts of interesting rhetorical issues embedded therein. He's an entrepreneur, consultant, engineer. I'm going to call you a conservationist just as a coverall term, but we'll come back to that one.
All right.
And a former exec with Shell Oil. So welcome, Russ Conser.
Hey, Dan. Pleasure to be on.
What's going on? How's it going there? And you're in Houston, good. Right?
Yeah, I'm in Houston. So, some people call it East San Antonio or East Austin. So I'm not too far from you. In a bad traffic day, it takes me as long to get downtown Houston as it does to Austin. But yeah, just a little cool and drizzly, but at least spring is here after that big cold spell we had, right? And
yeah, we have all sorts of good fronts coming in. We got the vaccine front coming in. We've got, spring and summer coming in. There's some hope in the air.
There is some hope in the air. So some buds on the trees help give nature's balance to that hope too. So it's cool.
Yeah, we were driving yesterday and all the blue bonnets were starting to pop yeah. up. And that's the whole thing about
it's sexist.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Time for all the it's time for all the suburban moms to get out and get pictures of them sitting
with the babies by the roadsides blocking traffic as everybody's pulled off on the shoulder. It's a uniquely Texas thing for those of you know from Texas. Yeah. It's kind of crazy. Yeah. I grew up in Nebraska, so that was foreign to me, but we did it too when our babies were little, right? Take the kids out there, set them in a field of blue bonnets and snap some photos.
Hey, don't pay attention to the fire ants. The flowers are pretty.
Just got to be quick.
Yeah. No, that is one of the things I think it's very interesting about Texas just in general. The history of Texas never goes away. Like, the history of Texas is always present. So you have all the nature, you have all the, cattle, it's all still here. It just regenerates over and over again.
Yeah. Our human footprint in Texas is actually incredibly recent, right? I used to tell people, I lived in Europe for a couple of years and my house was as old as the Alamo, right? And the Alamo is a museum in Texas, right? It's like ancient history for
right.
us. And, it's just, we just have no sense of that long-term history. It may be a tangent here, but I'm enjoying wrapping up a read from one of my good friends from my former life in big oil. It was a geologist that actually rewound the clock 22,000 years to when humans first showed up here in the coastal Texas and hill country area. It's just a remarkable story. And you're right. We really are living out the consequences of the history we've already been through with the system and the human part, the whole freeways and, that kind of stuff is, it's all new, but even the traditions, right? So barbacoa, right? Cooking your beef in the ground, right? That goes back to the indigenous people here, tens of thousands of years ago. It's pretty cool. Texas is a place where the past is still present. It's largely broken, but it kind of makes it fun as well. You can kind of immerse yourself in it. And I love the people here. And
it's fascinating too that the mythologies live on, stories live on pretty easily. Like, it's kind of hard to get rid of the big characters that exist in stories. The actual information, from like barbacoa or old right. cooking techniques and things like that, that stuff, does not get transferred very easily forward.
Right.
There's a great line from Hannah Arendt that says that, our, our inheritance is left to us by no testament. So all the things that we should inherit from all this good human thought and practice throughout history, we don't get.
Yeah, only through our cultural traditions, right? And then once we, if we let go of those, right, you forget them and everything just becomes an rational, objective exercise. And you don't realize the connectivity and the purpose and some of that stuff. I think that's true in food as well, right? I mean, absolutely. My own food journey was very much, I mean, I was a kid, grew up in the 60s, right? I thought Tang and Kraft macaroni and cheese and even Spam was, you know, really
natural. It grew somewhere. It
was
right?
Awesome. This was progress, right? And sure. Little did I realize that all these wonderful techniques of producing food, growing food, processing food, it's really remarkable how our ancestors knew how to, you know, minimize the toxins and maximize the nutrients in what they're doing. With this Blue Nest beef thing, we've just introduced a shelf-stable meat snack stick that's naturally fermented. And as I was reading up on this natural fermentation process, it was kind of perfected by the Roman legions, but it really goes back to Mesopotamia, right? The way of curing meat when you don't have chemistry and all the advantages of modern technology. But I'm going to tell you, it leaves a really tasty product too. And I think it's simultaneously nourishing and delightful for that kind of stuff. So rediscovering some of the joy in what our ancestors knew and maybe we forgot because we didn't pass it down, right, the testimonies. To me, that's like a major theme in the last 10 years of my life. You know, because I know you and I have common roots in the food stuff, when I didn't discover this whole kind of, you know, became kind of faddish later, the paleo concept type stuff until I was 51 years old. And I was just like, holy crap, this is good. I feel good. The food's good. Why did I waste 51 years eating crappy stuff? Right. I just think it's there's a joy in rediscovering the lessons of our own history that we forgot, maybe thought were irrelevant. And it turns out, wow, that's really cool. And useful.
And you asked me, you know, we talk about this from time to time about, you know, what rhetoric is and how to actually use it and actualize it into the world. And part of it, it's this, like when you look at what, you know, that quote about what human beings have developed, you know, through the genius of millions of people doing this for thousands of years, figuring out all the techniques. And the fact that you would think that that stuff is what we want to harvest. That is the most valuable things we have as human beings to keep us healthy and keep us moving forward and all this. But so many things interrupt that, you know, so many cultures move around, people move around, technology comes in and it all just becomes noise so that that can't come through. And when you see something like Blue Nest Beef or paleo or carnivore, these diets that come up, essentially they found a story that can go back and cut through that noise.
Yeah.
You know,
nice way to frame it.
Way for people.
I like that. I like that a lot. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but thanks for that gift. That's really good. I feel it, right? I mean, even in my own journey here, I don't want to open any tangents, but I came into this whole, you know, the first doorway into food for me was my own personal health, actually trying to deal with the degrading health of my own father. Along that road, as I was exploring food that was good for me, I learned that food could be produced in a way that did good things for the planet too. And because of my background as an engineer and manager in the oil and gas industry, challenges for climate change solutions were really on the tip of my tongue. They were just forward in my thought all the time, right? And everyone was paying attention to how do we reduce emissions, right? The outflow side of that kind of negative planetary impact type stuff. And what I accidentally stumbled upon was that the way we grow food and fiber can be right at the heart of the solution to the other half of that carbon problem, which is taking carbon out of the air and putting it back to work, growing life in soil. And that just kind of opened my eyes to this whole, you know, crazy new area of stuff, but it's really complicated too, man. I could bore you silly talking about thermodynamics and photosynthesis and microbial interactions and all these really kind of really cool things. But how do I boil it down to simple things that allow us to have a story that that penetrates? So like this Blue Nest Beef thing really came out of a, hey, there's a lot of cool ways where we can like quantify things, put them in spreadsheets, charts, graphs, websites, all the kind of stuff on climate benefits of things like that. But for now, we can start with something simple, count the birds, right? You know, and we partnered up with the Audubon Society to roll out a market solution coupled up with their conservation ranching program, thus your conservationist thing. And you know, it's just kind of a scratch in the tip of the iceberg, but it's a good iceberg. I think, you know, you're really, you're trying to take this really complicated story of how Earth works and how health and people, planet are connected to one another, but, you know, reduce it down to something that, you know, anybody can kind of get their minds around. So if you call that rhetoric, you know, awesome, then we're certainly trying anyway.
Yeah, rhetoric's the conscious application of these ideas. People do this stuff sort of informally, yeah, you know, without sort of the conscious theory. I always break it down to this kind of acronym of TSTE. It's theory, strategy, tactics, and experience. Mm-hmm. And most people don't have a ton of formal theory. And mm-hmm. rhetoric has, you know, way more than it can use. It's kind of like, you know, when you jump into the science of it all, rhetoric will do that with the language of it all.
Right.
So one of the things that's always interested me about your stuff from a rhetorical perspective, when you started talking about it, you have the first thing I usually do is I come in and do an audit of whoever I'm working with. And there's that America's grassland birds. You have three super strong symbols there to work with. Mm. You know, grassland birds, nobody ever thinks about grassland birds.
Nope, they don't.
But they've got a huge tradition within our stories here of like pioneers, and clearly they'd be healthy because the big, you know, grasslands are a healthy symbol, and you know, it's American. So you've got all that good, rich rhetorical soil to work with.
Yeah, it's true. And I didn't even know it at the time. I actually stumbled onto this stuff after when I was just in the process of retiring from big oil. I was at Shell, as you know, for many, many years. And one of my colleagues challenged me to put together a story that Shell might be able to pick up and carry forward, this nature as a carbon sequestration solution. And in the oil and gas industry, we have this tradition of projects get to be named by whoever thinks them up, right? So I'm like, okay, what am I going to call this project? Putting carbon back into the soil? And I grew up in Nebraska, where our state bird was the meadowlark, right? Which is an iconic grassland bird. And so we called it Project Meadowlark. And to this day, if you go to people in Shell and ask them, because this category of nature-based solutions is now front and center in every bit of Shell strategy, we successfully catalyzed change that long outlived, you know, my own direct engagement with that stuff. But it came back in my own mind to this, literally sitting at my desktop going, what do I call my project? Oh, a meadowlark, right? It was the simplest. A meadowlark happens to be a bird that nests in the hoof prints of grazing bison and cattle. And when those bison and cattle aren't there in that natural ecosystem, the meadowlark doesn't have anywhere to live. So you get these massive population declines. And I guess I was tapping into the story of Nebraska as the center of America, birds and grasslands, because we consider ourselves a prairie state. So,
yeah,
you're absolutely right. Cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Even I think with, again, this idea of us moving away from our history so constantly in America, because we're constantly being fed new stories, mm-hmm. you know, new technologies, everything else. So we're always moving forward. And we straggle along with things from our past, but like the meadowlark, mm-hmm. there are certain birds that I remember growing up. My grandparents had a farm in Indiana, mm-hmm. and I would go over there, and it was the only time I was ever aware of birds.
Right.
Because they would wake you up in the middle of the night, like a bobwhite or a whippoorwill. You know, I don't even know what these birds are. A lark.
I knew them by their song though, right? Yeah.
I kind of started to learn them a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, but I was there for a week in the summers and then I was gone.
Right.
But when you went there, like that nature and just that sort of richness of all the animals around you that you never even would think of.
Yeah, I mean, again, to me, the scientist and engineer in me, I'm really and still very deeply engaged with several science projects that are doing cool stuff, including this really cool approach where we can literally count the carbon going in and out of any ecosystem in real time, kind of like the power meter on your house. It's way cool. But I tell people, don't worry about it. You know, if you want to know if an acre of land is doing something good for the world or not, walk out into it. And if you see a bunch of birds and dragonflies and butterflies, you know, it's good. Yeah, and it really, they're like the perfect biological sensor, right? They go to where they can find habitat and food, and you know, they're happy there. They lay their eggs, and it really is a great way of simplifying the complexity of all this interconnected stuff that, you know, you can't expect everyone to be an ecologist or you know, a physicist that's going to try to quantify all this stuff, but everybody can walk into a pasture and see if birds are singing or they're just gone. Is it silent, right?
Yeah, and there's been quite a bit of pop culture on the lower level of pop culture lately, like Biggest Little Farm.
Mm-hmm. Great movie.
You know, and there's been a few of those that have come up, stories, and some of them have been turned into films. And it does, like, they go and the photography is so good, and to document, you know, the experience, experiential, like, yep. You get a vicarious experience of watching what nature is supposed to look like, so that, you know, you get people who are city people or suburban people,
right.
And that's so foreign to them, but those kind of stories well told with very good photography, right. Can give you some of that. Again, you can
that sense.
Create a nostalgia for it in a way, which is kind of what Blue Nest Beef does.
Yeah, I think nostalgia is an important part of it. I mean, where did you grow up, Dan? You said you went to Indiana to your grandparents' farm, but where did you grow up?
I'm from Kentucky, but I was in a suburb like Louisville, like on the edge of the city of Louisville. So there was rural around us. But
you got out in nature as a kid?
My grandfather would take me fishing and hunting.
Yeah, okay.
In, you know, there you Indiana.
Go. Yeah, yeah. No, I think, and thus the nostalgia, right? I mean, it's not as much anymore, right? I mean, kids grow up and they get scheduled from soccer season to basketball season to...
Yeah, what do you get, nostalgia for your soccer ball, you know?
Exactly, right? All these opportunities. I mean, I remember we did all that stuff, but it was kind of secondary to running around in parks and, you know, hiking on trails. And just as long... I grew up in the age where, you know, it was the so-called 60s wonder years. As long as you were home for dinner, everything was good, right? And so we got to learn the world that way, and I think learned a lot of things we didn't know we were learning at the time, and a lot of those lessons have been lost. And so, yeah, trying to figure out how to rediscover. And I think food is a good gateway. Everybody eats, right?
Sure.
And once you realize that there is a story behind what you're putting in your mouth, where it came from, what happened to it, who made it, the impact it had on the world. You know, I think it's a place where all of us can figure out, you know, we're part of something bigger. It's, you know, less clear when you fill your car with gas or, you know, a lot of other things we do, right? But right. Eating is inherently a biological and natural act. And let's hope it remains that way. I know there's some people that are on a mission to try to change that, but.
How does that feel to you, like, as a persuader yourself? Because, like you said, I've followed you on Facebook through the sort of COVID tracking, and and I watch, you know, how well you react when somebody lays something out nicely on a graph and has a really clean perspective on the data. And usually you find, you know, a better perspective on the data than what is sort of being given out through the media. And that kind of persuasion is really strong. And engineers usually like that kind of persuasion. They like the numbers and to really track it like that, because it feels much more solid. You move over into this and it becomes almost all storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah, so, no, it is. It's absolutely this marriage between data and storytelling. And my comfort zone absolutely historically is data. And I think in the scientific progress world, it does come down to data in the long run. But one of the things I've learned significantly as I've matured is that storytelling has a much, much broader impact in how people receive and process information and think about change. You mentioned Biggest Little Farm, another movie, Kiss the Ground, really powerful movies. One of the farmers I know, Gabe Brown in North Dakota, just testified before the U.S. House Ag Committee here several weeks ago. And it was all catalyzed because one of the staffers for the committee chair had seen Kiss the Ground and said, "Hey, boss, you need to watch this thing." And so they preceded his testimony by showing a little segment from the film. They didn't call Russ Kontzer and ask for a chart. right. And in time, you know, things, and of course today we're living in an age where the same data can just be spun mercilessly, and surprisingly distorting, approaches. I truly believe that data approached objectively and honestly can, you know, reveal important truths. But I think that the storytelling turns out to be more important. In fact, my own journey here, the other piece of the puzzle for me that fell into place was one of the other movie producers here. You may have seen Soil Carbon Cowboys series of films on this whole regenerative agriculture thing. Peter Bick, who's one of my best friends now, you know, I gave a talk where I showed charts on the subject of innovation at a place called the Urban Land Institute. And one of the guys in the audience just said, "Hey, you need to meet my friend Peter, the movie maker, because there's just something about you." And anyhow, Peter and I basically teamed up and become this kind of odd tag team, you know, whether it's Oscar and Felix or, you know, Mutt and Jeff, I don't know. But, you know, we collaborate on science projects. He's putting together, you know, continues to put together important movies. It was a couple of years ago when one of my business partners here, Dr. Alan Williams, is really working with, as like Gabe Brown, who I mentioned, to educate farmers on these production methods. And they were just starting to do kind of these classes of stuff. And talking to Alan as he was in the truck on the way home from teaching a class to a group of farmers who were very eager to learn. And I said, "Well, what is it about them that they had in common?" He said, "Well, you know, they were young and old and they're different. Some farm this and some farm that, but you know what? Almost universally, every one of them had seen a video of Gabe Brown on YouTube." And that catalyzed them to become interested and want to learn more about the subject. So that's this whole storytelling dimension to change is something I've been learning slowly but surely and gaining a deep appreciation for over time in this system. And I think it is absolutely true. I mean, this is cultures rise and fall on stories. We all have our myths and legends, right? The Joseph Campbell type stuff. But they hold us together. They direct us. They help transfer learnings. And here in this context, where we're trying to create a positive change of some kind, I think they give us some handholds to understand why we're going where we're going and what it might look like and feel like. I don't know. You're probably more the pro here, but.
Well, I think that's the, you know, the challenge to people is when they see this, like anytime you start to get into sales or marketing or social issue work or politics or anything else, you realize you've got a set of ideas and assets and products over here, and you've got to have ways of getting them into people's minds. Mm-hmm. You recognize that everybody feels that. And mm-hmm. your first thing are to try to go logic and try to explain the value of them and be clearly communicative, which is the great thing about engineers and charts and all that kind of stuff, is that it sets the information first mm-hmm. before it starts, you know, giving advice or making claims. Mm-hmm. And so it's very good with evidence. It's just, that's such a slow process.
It is.
And public sort of public persuasion is incredibly fast. It's incredibly competitive. It's never monologue where you just get to say something, because you're in a competitive space, no matter whether you're in business or politics or social issues, somebody's going to come along and start ripping at your story.
They're right.
Ripping at your data. And if they tell their side in a more compelling way, or if they know how to torpedo right. your side, then you just go down. Like it's.
That's right. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to be able to hold on to my spreadsheet as I drown in an ocean of a better argued story. I absolutely agree with that.
which is tough. I mean, it's tough on people that really do value information, because we end up making so many decisions based on bad information in modern culture.
Well, and bad information, or it's often partial information or information that's been wrapped into somebody else's story, right? You know, one of the things that's absolutely true is we all see the world through the eyes we have, and the eyes we have are shaped by the experiences we've already had. And we tend to, I mean, you've probably given lectures on confirmation bias, right? right? It's such a real thing, right? You develop a set of beliefs, you look at the world looking for data to support your beliefs. It's a very human thing to do. From an evolutionary perspective, there's a good reason that it works that way. But when you're trying to drive change, it's really hard. But people, I mean, look, we've learned it during COVID here. People will, I mean, if the data starts pushing back on what they believe, they'll just scream in defiance and denial louder, right? So,
yeah, information has a hard time in modern media and culture.
Yeah.
It's just not protected very well. When I first started doing work for businesses in the marketing agency, it drove me crazy how they would make decisions on 4% of information or miss, you know, I'm like, you can't make decisions on poor information and expect good decisions. So I did some early work about setting up to show people how to clean data, how to clean information so that you can hand it from stage to stage. So by the time you get to a decision, you've got fairly reliable information. But if you don't take it through that process, or if you let anybody jump into that process and, you know, cause trouble, then your information's going to just skits out again. And
yeah,
so easy to do.
Fascinating. Yeah. Oh, really intriguing. No, again, I come from a long professional career of dealing with bleeding edge science and stuff like that really did submit to the information thing. I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't, if you're looking for an oil field, it's either there or it's not, right? It's this big or it's that big. It's an information and data-driven decision-making thing, and the cost and economics of exploiting it are very defined. The rest of the living world is quite a bit different than that. So it's fun. And for me, this whole idea of trying to take something I truly believe in that's a really big cause and then wrap it in a business that can engage consumers in a different story to kind of transect that understanding of something, it's a whole new challenge, right? So every day is a challenge, but it's fun, right? I mean, I feel like I'm a kid out of school again, right? You know, learning a whole new field.
Yeah, that's great. So I know the story, but take people real quickly through the story of Blue Nest Beef, because I think it is fascinating.
Well, on the surface, we're a box of beef that comes from land that's been managed differently, that's frozen and processed and shows up on your doorstep. So to the consumer, we look like a website you can click on and get a box of amazing beef to show up on your doorstep. And then that beef comes with a story, though, that doesn't just taste great, it does good, right? So this duality, this is one of the things I think that's a little bit hard in our mindset as well, is to hold two ideas in our head at the same time. In a lot of ways it's true, but it's also deep in our beliefs that the process of doing something leads to the loss of something else. And you know, my own journey here into this kind of beef, what I call better beef with a bigger purpose, started because of this experience I had in 30 years. I'm an engineer and a scientist, come from the oil and gas industry, right? Kind of in a career that was roughly divided between finding and exploring for oil and gas all around the world to technology, venturing and investing in alternative energy and even conventional energy technology systems. And one unsolved problem was not just how we reduce emissions from the production of energy, but how do we capture the legacy emissions from the energy that we've produced over the last many decades. And that's a really difficult problem to solve. And a lot of us wanted to approach that thing from the perspective of engineering solutions. And one day I just kind of stumbled into this space where I was introduced to the idea that the way we grow food has the potential to recapture that carbon from the atmosphere and put it to work in soil, growing healthier food. And I tell people my life changed the day when the two parts of my world connected, because someone brought forward samples back to the data as evidence to me, an engineer, about the quantity and distribution of carbon in the soil. And I recognized that immediately is the same type of quantity and distribution of carbon in soil as we would see in a source rock that produced oil and gas once you had buried it deep in the earth. So what these farmers were really doing was recreating the processes that stored carbon in the earth in the first place before it was buried and turned into oil and gas in a process that took millions of years. And as I started spending more time with farmers who were doing this, it struck me that it works everywhere. There were a lot of people doing it, but they were all working at small scale. And it kind of reminded me of what renewable energy was like about 25, 30 years ago, where the only person with the solar panel was your crazy Uncle Harry living off grid in Idaho, right? You know, right. It was a rebellious thing. It wasn't a functional thing, right? But at that time, investors and entrepreneurs entered the space and said, well, how do we translate this into something that can scale up? So if this is a good thing, how do we get more of the good thing? The phrase we use in Blue Nest Beef now is, how do we make the right thing the easy thing? Because that's going to increase the chance that that right thing is actually then going to happen. So we set off to try to create a business that could take the first step, just the first step, in trying to move the needle in the right direction where we can take this. It turns out that one of the fastest ways to sequester the most carbon at the largest scale is by working with cattle that graze on grass, which is a perennial photosynthesizer. And so the question was, how do we make the beef business work differently at scale? And the pieces fell into place about 2 years ago when the National Audubon Society, having come to the conclusion quite separately, really, that and much to the surprise of people, but to your earlier point, the largest category of endangered birds in North America are grassland birds. And most people have no clue. I like to tell people, we have lost just over 50% of all grassland birds in North America in just the last 50 years. So that's since the first Earth Day, since Silent Spring was written, right? So whatever we changed at Earth Day, whatever we changed when Rachel Carson testified before Congress, it might have slowed the decline, but it certainly didn't stop it, right? And it turns out that the practices you use in producing, grazing beef cattle to bring back birds and sequester carbon are pretty much the same. What you do is you replicate the natural behavior of roaming bison that stay together in dense herds, moving frequently and not coming back to the same place too often. That effectively operates a carbon pump that ends up pumping carbon and accumulating it in the soil. And then Blue Nest Beef was created because they had this, they were starting to scale the acreage where people were conforming to these new protocols. And we realized, look, there's already millions of Americans that love birds, right? They go birding on weekends. The National Audubon Society has a regular conversation with them. And we said, well, why don't we start there? Let's start by putting the face of a bird, which is a much simpler object to understand than Russ's long soliloquy about carbon in soil.
A graph of birds.
You just put the face of bird on a ton of carbon, and we'll start selling the story of a better beef that does good things for birds. And by way of that, introduce people into a story of a whole different way of producing food in time. So that said, we're no different than any other startup. We've just been in business a little over a year. We've been shipping boxes. We now ship boxes to all 48 lower U.S. states. The core of our business has been frozen beef. We really, truly believe we can deliver the highest quality beef product you'll eat today. And then we've just now introduced this shelf-stable, naturally fermented beef snack stick that I mentioned, which gives us opportunities to get into the pantry and not just in the freezer with this story of better beef with a bigger purpose. So we're working on that now. We've actually named that product after a grassland bird called a bubble link. So our convenient convergence of language there for you, I guess, right? And link conveys a sausage, at least in Texas, and it's a half of a word of one of these endangered birds. So the bobolinks are our new shelf-stable, naturally fermented beef stick, and that's kind of fun. So learning how to indeed translate all this complexity into something that consumers can experience and go, well, damn, that was good. And then, you know, to me, you know, Dan, this is probably worthy of its own conversation, but there's some legacy stuff in, you know, I think Western culture that's pretty deeply rooted. You even mentioned it early of guilt based thinking of stuff, but and a lot of marketing this way is anchored in that. But, you know, we want people to feel good about their food again. Net feel good is both the direct effect, like I eat something and I feel good, right? Like I said, that's what happened to me when I hit my 50s and I realized I didn't have to eat SpaghettiOs for lunch because they were, you know, it's
again, aren't those naturally occurring? Don't they grow, pasta O's out in, you know?
Somewhere? Yeah, exactly. You know, damn, they taste good because, you know, other scientists figured out how to hit your taste buds in just the right way to make you want to eat more. But the other thing is the feel good of the feel good about what we eat, right? Which is, the whole alternative meat sector right now is driven by people that are either trying to create plant-based alternatives or entirely synthetic, grown de novo and vat alternatives to meat. And on the one hand, they may be legitimate pursuits. I would try to help them understand that they just haven't seen the deeper roots of the bigger problem, but, you know, wish them all the best in their efforts. What I say is what we're doing is the other alternative. The other alternative, one of the phrases I coined very, very early on in this process is not the cow, it's the how. So, you know, we focus on the noun, the cow, as if it's the object of the evil. It's easy because it's the scapegoat, literally, that we can, you know, make evil and try to make go away, make that evil cow disappear. When the reality is the thing that's wrong is the method by which we've produced that cattle that's left all these negative externalities of pollution. People look at that and go, I don't feel good about that. They look at the animal welfare conditions. I don't feel good about that. And so, you know, one of the things we're trying to do here with Blue Nest Beef is allow people to feel good about their food again, right? Which is, you feel good when you eat it, and you feel good about the world when you eat it. And how we effectively message that with our customers now in the future, you know, I think we'll still be learning, but that's kind of the essence, if you will, of the intent. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, I think your engineering talk is wearing off on my brain. I got the sense of like, you need to set up a quadrant system for your story points. So, you know, in one quadrant, you've got the birds. Yeah. And here are your top eight birds that people will kind of recognize and have an emotive response to, like, oh yeah, definitely save the meadowlark, that thing.
Right.
I love that thing.
Yeah.
You know, and over here you've got the cows.
Yeah.
Which, as you said, there's these sort of pseudo cattle that have been created through big farms and all that, but versus like almost bison wild.
Right. Yep.
Natural.
Bison's the right iconic picture, huh?
And if you look out and you can see like the stars of your story points sitting out there that you can just pluck one every time you need it and just harvest it and move it over. Mm. So when I look at it, like you do have a very complicated set of, of messaging, but your engineering could almost split it up and organize it for yourself. And
yeah, fascinating. That is right. And learning those skills, like I said, I mean, that's what's new for me. Which is fun. So consider me a rhetoric newbie student, you know, in how to translate what I know from kind of an engineering and science perspective into stories and messaging that can help people, you know, be a part of, because that's one of the fun things about food as well, right? Is that it's not like some distant like genetic engineering or artificial intelligence that people feel like they're not engaged with. Everybody makes a choice on what they eat every day, right? So everybody can make a difference in this one by simply choosing a different food system. So there really is an opportunity for each and every consumer to participate in creating a new story here. So it's a fun challenge to have.
when we were talking before about sort of the history of food, that jerky, a good example. Mm-hmm. So if your quadrant is sitting over here is food, yeah. and we've all been moved off into techno food, science food, Tang and
right.
Slim Jim.
I think Tang must be gone by now, but yeah, you and I know what it was.
That something like jerky. I remember when I moved back to Texas, one of the times I've moved back to Texas, I'll never forget this. I pulled up to the house I bought and I was getting ready to unload. And there was a guy sitting across, this is so Austin. There's a guy sitting across the street on his front porch. And he's like, "You moving in?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "You want a beer and some jerky?" And he had made jerky and he had a bowl full of jerky and a six pack next to him. And I went and had a beer and some jerky to welcome me back to Texas.
Yeah. That's such a great Texas thing, right? You know, jerky is what you do with, you know, the real purpose of going hunting is the experience of hunting, right? And then you end up with some jerky that you got to munch on all year long to really keep the thing moving.
But it has, it's one of those foods. And I think when you look at foods and the stories they carry, jerky goes all the way back to pemmican, right? And
that's right.
The Native Americans and dried beef and how that let them be nomads, yep. and all that kind of stuff. And it comes right up to, it gets co-opted by, you know, like capitalism has never really been able to co-opt dried beef very well. You know, they got Slim Jims into the 7-Elevens, but.
It's a hot category these days. There's a lot of people doing interesting things in that, but I think we've yet to fully appreciate, when we had these technological innovations that, you know, fundamentally changed everything, like refrigeration, right? Suddenly fresh meat became so accessible universally that all the traditional cultural methods for producing, preserving food just evaporated, right? And so kind of, you know, rediscovering some of these things. And having been involved in really bleeding edge science for so long, I kind of approach all science humbly. One of the things I've learned about food is that there's a lot more that we don't know than what we do know. And same is true about soil, by the way. But we know enough to do some interesting things and make progress. But if we ever forget that there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on that doesn't show up on the nutrition label, then you're likely to get somewhere down the road and find out you screwed something up, right? I don't know, this is part of the genius of our ancestors, right? You know, they may not have been able to make progress fast, but they thrived for millennia. And one way or another, maybe it's because the people who got it wrong all died, but
pretty clean system.
Pretty clean system, right? But, you know, in general, they developed all kinds of mechanisms and recipes and approaches for, you know, even fasting, right? I don't know if you and I have ever talked about fasting before. Every religious tradition in the world has some sort of fasting tradition in somewhere. And I think only in the last 5 to 10 years has scientific research gone back into going, well, that fasting thing, that actually, there's some really powerful things that happen with fasting. So I think our ancestors were much better scientists than we give them credit for. They just didn't have the spreadsheets and charts and detailed mechanistic understandings of how it all happened yet. And I think if you approach any of this stuff with appropriate humility, you can make progress. In fact, in a lot of ways, I think that, it's long since defunct. When I retired from Shell almost 8 years ago now, I started a blog called Reconnecting Dots. And at a high level, what I would say is that, you know, what scientific progress has allowed us to do over the last 10,000 years, but especially the last 500, is we break things into pieces and understand all those pieces. But what we lost by letting go of our cultural heritage was how all those pieces fit together in systems that allow holes and communities to work, where that hole is your body or your neighborhood or your family, or whatever the case may be. And I think now that we've kind of broken the universe down into tiny, tiny little particles where we understand truly what dots are and how they interact with one another, I think the challenge of the next age is about figuring out how to put all those pieces back together again. And it's kind of like undoing Humpty Dumpty, if you will, is kind of that's what we're trying to do. And I think food is the first, but certainly not the last place where, you know, that we have an opportunity to do that, because our current food system is killing us first and foremost. And it's going to take the planet along with us with it if we don't change course. So,
well, we're literally not made to process this much information, right? If you think about the way cultures were and communities were, they lived in one place,
right?
Traveled around some, but for thousands of years, and nature was basically the same for thousands of years. So you study one thing in depth through experience over time, and you know that thing, and it doesn't change very much.
It doesn't change.
Now you could walk into any grocery store in the world and find things you have no idea what they are, where they came from. And maybe you could break it down if you know a little bit about the ingredients and, you know, a little bit about food and that kind of stuff. You still don't know anything about it. We're not, our apparatus is not made to process information like this.
No, it's not at all. And in fact, one of the favorite stories that I just posted on social media this morning from this book that my friend wrote from the history of Southeast Texas here was one of the long held anthropological mysteries here was the Brazos River. I sit just a few miles to the east side of the Brazos. You're, of course, on the west side of the Brazos, and depending on where you are in Austin, north or south of the Colorado, right? But there's a language barrier on the Brazos, where basically the indigenous peoples that lived to the east had a completely different language system than the people that lived to the west. And they're like no words in common whatsoever, right? They were like Martian and Venus language type systems. And no one ever really understood that. One of the pieces that fell into place last night is the author and my friend here kind of wove it back together was, in order to see where those cultures subdivided, you have to rewind the clock 20,000 years. And the coastline of Texas was 100 miles or so offshore of where it is now. And there were river systems where there were two entirely self-contained river systems that were separated. And the people lived on the coastline and they kept backing up as the sea level rose. But those roots of those different river systems that they started out with were retained in the language that sits with us today, which is just to me a marvelous example of how, you know, the land and society and culture fit together. They couldn't process information. They had no need to process information across that thing. They developed their own information processing language within their context there. And it stuck with them for 22,000 years, minus the 300 that, you know, when the Europeans showed up, they all disappeared rather rapidly. So it is fascinating to think of this interface between the history that we've come from and the present we're in and the future we're trying to build. And yet I couldn't feel more strongly we have all the tools we need now, and we have the really important need or the imperative to do it now, figure out how to get these systems working again. And human health is, I think, made a lot of progress in the last 10 years. You've got functional medicine again, that's really, instead of looking at you as, you know, oh, your ear is broken or your heart is broken or your knee is broken or whatever, the functional medicine physicians are looking at how does the whole body work again. And I think we're going to have to do that same kind of thing in how we produce food and how we do everything.
Sounds like a big project. Sounds like 800,000 big projects.
Yeah, exactly. For another 22,000 years, right?
Right.
But, you know, I think that's the problem here is our Western mindset and our many projects of the last 500 years have done amazing things. We've grown the planet. We've invented technology. We've done all this stuff. But in the process, if we break it so that it doesn't work anymore, then we got a problem. So,
yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned earlier the highways and things like that. You build things because you need them in the moment. You don't build them that they may become inconvenient and dangerous 200 years from now. You know, it's we don't have that kind of scope. And we've kind of gotten there now, right? Where we've got at least some idea of scope, at least this idea of holism and the fact that you're always being myopic when you're working on your one thing and trying to make a living and trying to get this thing to work. and you don't look at all the ramifications. You know, you can't always see that stuff. But I know, like, with, you look at geological anthropology like that, where you're like, oh, there's a river, it used to be here, and that now explains 20,000 years later.
Right.
People in rhetoric, it's sometimes the same thing. Like, the South mystifies a lot of people, and rural communities and rural politics mystify most Democrats and sort of educated liberals in the cities. They're like, how could people think like that? I'm like, well, if you look at the traditions of those areas, you know, they are still largely story-based. They're not information-based cultures. Their religion, you know, is the strongest form of indoctrination in that culture.
Story translation.
You know, and education is built around very centralized ideas. It's not yet moved out into the things that you're studying. And then you have families and the way that family is done in those cultures. So if you want to go in and influence those people, you know, within those kind of cultures, then you understand the foundations of the cultures and you adjust your talk so it can work. You don't just talk louder, you know,
right,
or show more of these kind of things until they, surely they'll get it, right?
Right.
You know, you have to translate to that, to either side of the river. You have to translate.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Another gift. You keep giving me gifts today, Dan. This is great.
Rhetoric, the gift that keeps on giving that most people don't even know exists.
Yeah, no, I mean, to me, you know, the last time I really, you know, I'm trying to think of the high school English class of composition and rhetoric, where you go through several different formulaic theories and learn how to argue your case this way. Then you turn around the next week and argue it the other way, and then the next way. So I'm just, you know, I chose to become an engineer.
Yeah, this is language engineering. Charts. In some ways, this is language engineering. It is
language engineering. Yeah, in its own way.
And, you know, most people don't get a lot of training in it. They get that kind of debate, argument, sort of logic based, which isn't persuasion. It's sort of warfare.
Yeah, it's warfare. Point scoring. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not really like, I'm not coming out of this persuaded. You know.
Right.
So it's been fun trying to adjust this stuff, and that's why I get interested in. That's why I wanted you on the podcast, is because this stuff is active in your life right now.
I'm living it.
Very important on many different fronts, from the conversations or conservation stuff, all the way over to running a new business and making that viable, you know?
Right.
So this stuff it's making a difference for you right now.
Yeah, it absolutely is, every day. And like I said, that's what makes it fun though, right? Is that I can do charts, graphs, and spreadsheets. And you probably see that in social media sometimes. That part of got cold, right? This, how do we engage people in a story that creates space for people and persuade, you know, maybe there's better words in that you professionals have that you can use. Persuade sounds like very one way, like I have all the right answers and I got to get you to follow me. And I think the future, you know, so there's something in here in rediscovering of conversation that leads to a shared truth that allows us to come forward in some way, not in a compromise kind of way, but in a way that's like, hey, I learned something. Like,
I'll give you one technical term you can use for that. In rhetoric, it's rhetoric versus dialectics.
Okay.
So dialectics is the study of the process, the at least binary process of, like you said, working your way through ideas until you both reach a singular point that you can handle, or that you agree that's good enough. And dialectics, you know, I see this a lot with people where they will pull back from me a lot of times when they hear rhetoric or persuasion, because it sounds to them like they substitute the word manipulation in on me real quick. I'm like, I didn't say manipulation.
Right.
You know, persuasion gets slandered very easily and pulled over into unethical persuasion, which is why the slogan for Rhetoric Warriors is the power of ethical only persuasion.
No.
You don't need to do deception. You don't need to do trickery or, you know, manipulation and that stuff to bring people to a position. You need to be able to tell a good, vibrant, clean story.
Right.
Like you're doing with Blue Nest Beef. And I think when I look at that, I'm like, yeah, as soon as I remember when you and what's your partner's name?
Todd Churchill.
Yeah, right? Todd. The first time I talked to you guys and you're like grassland, American grassland birds. And I'm like, yeah, I would just say that a million times.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, we're still, we probably have said it a million times in the last year. One of the advantages we have is, and there's probably some, another rhetoric formula that you have in your little holster of tricks. But this kind of unlikely combination of birds and beef cattle is a great entry ticket, because it almost always leads to a raised eyebrow. Hold on, right? It creates a doorway into which you can have a conversation. You know, it's not one that people would intuit for themselves, but once you start talking about it, you know, they kind of get the idea. And then I think that the harder challenge for us is engaging the everyday consumer in a way that's meaningful for them, you know, for that last leg here of, you know, how can I as a consumer sincerely make the decision, and why should I make the decision to participate in this different kind of food system to help create a better world being. And yeah, I'll get some great tastes and beef out of the deal, but I'm also a part of something bigger. And how do I value that and appreciate that? I think our historical cultures ascribed a much higher value to that, and we had processes for it. I don't know if you ever read a book called What Technology Wants. What a great title.
That was a great title. No, I haven't read it.
Yeah. And but the most interesting chapters in that book, I think the author was Kevin Kelly, were stories of the Amish culture. And we all have this kind of idea in our mind that the Amish are just techno-resistant, right? They're a bunch of Luddites. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, really. I actually did a field trip up there one time, and you realize that the Amish are just amazingly innovative at figuring out how to work around a set of constraints that their culture places on them. But in that book, it is a really enlightening discussion of the process by which any innovation is welcome for experimentation, but after experimentation is brought before, you know, the wise elders of the community with a pitch on, you know, why this advances the good of the community or not, right? And then a decision is taken on board. What do we adopt this technology or innovation, or do we reject it? And so they have this cultural process there that they've, that's kept their culture alive for a long time, of, you know, how to make a decision about, like, wow, that's a really cool iPhone, or, you know, whatever the cool technology is. But to all, the other half of the conversation that we frequently don't do in the rest of society, which is, what does the incorporation of this technology in our society do the rest of society itself? And is that a good thing or not? And I don't know that there's any one perfect way to do that, but what I can say is that the Amish have an amazing process in place that I learned in that book that, you know, nicely describes, you know, the other half of that hidden half of the equation that, you know, those of us out here in the rest of the world just take for granted. Oh, it's awesome. I'll buy it. I'll take it, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know, there's a significant part of me after reading that book that goes, damn, well, okay, I get it now. I can kind of see how that really has worked really well for them. And gee, I wish we, you know, it's not like I get out of bed wishing I didn't have many of the luxuries I do.
Sure.
But I get out of bed going, gee, we could really be better if we adopted a process that allowed us to make those kind of decisions, because we don't do that.
Yeah, that's a great story. It's very, you know, when you get fragmented cultures, fragmented communities, which is what America is, you know, it's just a big patchwork. Everybody calls it a melting pot. I call it a melting pit. Like, it's just throw everything in there and who knows what's going to be, you know, rising up for a couple of decades and then back down. When you have fragmented societies like this, you can't do centralized decision-making like that. And you end up with, you know, in some ways it's good. You get good stuff out of it, I guess. And in some ways you clearly don't.
Yeah. And I don't know that centralized decision-making is it different forms of distribution, right? I'm sure you've read de Tocqueville's stuff, right? You know, and one of the things he certainly commented on in his 1830s there when he was traveling America and writing the stories was the remarkable capacity of American citizens to form unions and civil organizations at any scale, right?
Yeah.
Little clubs of 4, 5, and 6 in groups of 40 and 50 and 4 and 500. And so it was this very fractal oriented system for making decisions at different scales. And we institutionalize these things around churches and schools and You know, heck, we even wove those things together. When I first came to the South in the oil industry, I lived in Louisiana where you had a parish, right? The church and the state, you know, intersected there explicitly. And, I think we've kind of lost a lot of that stuff, and we haven't figured out how to, we still need those mechanisms, but we don't know what those mechanisms need to look like, because we kind of said goodbye to a lot of the mechanisms that we relied on for many, many years.
It's like we lost our grassland politics.
Yeah. Nice. You know, I lived in the Netherlands for 3 years when I lived in Europe, and they called it polder politics. And I don't know if you've heard that term before, but most people couldn't even point to the Netherlands on a map. And they might know the story of the little Dutch boy who put his finger in a dike, but roughly a third of the country is below sea level, and it's been reclaimed from sea by putting up dikes, pumping the water out back into the sea, and then making sure those dikes hold. And the politics is all around every little low area between dikes is called a polder. And the decision-making in the Netherlands is beautiful, because polder politics requires that everybody participate in the conversation and you come to consensus decision-making. It is not fast. It is painful. Loud voices can make things go slow.
Sure.
But it works. And they're a thriving country that has a third of their land area below sea level. And they're pretty happy people as well. So, and the equivalent of the grassland politics for North America or the bayou politics of, you know, coastal Texas and Louisiana, we've kind of, blown up a lot of those things without really intending to, right? And figured out how to do it. I mean, even, I don't really care if it's the melting pot or the melting pit, but, you know, when you and I were young, the idea that we would melt together and somehow share our flavor and make the whole thing better, that's to me what the word melting connotated. I think we've kind of lost that, right?
You know, overcook your vegetables and your
meat. Or overcook vegetables,
right? Ruin the stew.
Yeah, ruin the stew. How do we do that? I think we've got to rediscover all these things to allow us to live together in the stew, celebrate each other's flavor, and engage in that, there's no need to get out the pureeing device to make it all
right,
but it needs to work together in a system. And you know, once again, back to, you know, my world, I think food and health are one of the things we all participate in. I think it's a good place to start. I do hope it goes into, you know, whatever your focus, education or finance or science or other industry. Every endeavor, every field of endeavor known to man is kind of undergoing the same stresses and strains. In the modern era, it's almost remarkable, the endless parade of broken systems. You know, living here in Houston, right? The Enron shock of 20 years ago was a big shock, right?
Right.
But now it seems like Enron happens, you know, every other week on the news with somebody else in some other setting. It's not, and there's been a whole lot of MBA ethics classes that have taken place, and we continue to never be surprised at the stupid stuff that.
Yeah, a lot of times I think one of the things that you get with like an engineering focus or a formal rhetoric focus is that you at least gives you the field to look at, so that you can say, like, for me, I tell people all the time, it doesn't matter to me whether you're conservative or liberal. Mm-hmm. Those terms don't matter to me. Mm-hmm. What matters to me is how you persuade. Mm-hmm. So I can look at how you talk and tell you whether that is an ethical technique or an unethical technique. Mm. And if we just use ethical techniques, we'll be fine. If we get mixed up in unethical rhetoric, we won't be fine. Because it's very difficult to parse it out. It's very difficult to protect people from it. And it causes real problems. And I think you're seeing a lot of that now.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Just having people having those categories of, oh, these are ethical techniques and these are unethical would be a super training, you know, for the world. And then you can do whatever democracies or whatever you want with it. But if you have people using deception and facade talk and slander and all these kind of unethical techniques, no system works. It just doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. That, what a wonderful way to look at it. Another gift you've given me today.
I'll give you one more because I thought about this while you were talking, that you guys essentially right now in your business, you're experiencing what I would call glued down dominoes.
Okay.
Like you're building domino chains, like individual strands of things that you've got to knock over to get people to continue towards purchase. Uh-huh. And like, so the birds may be clean, like, oh yeah, birds, all good. There's no bad thing that pops up in that domino chain. Mm-hmm. But then you've got like beef, you know, or so down here, and then you would hit some vegans that are going to be kind of glued in place. Mm-hmm. And what is the things in each one of your domino chains, which are a glued down domino that you're not knocking over yet, that's stopping people from going all the way through to purchase?
Wow. Fascinating. That one's going to cause me to stay up late tonight or wake up in the middle of the night contemplating what are the glued down dominoes that are part of the big purchase decision chain.
Because they're in there.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I have absolutely no doubt. You know, one of the things I believe about innovation and change is I don't need to change everybody out of the gate. In fact, I'm better off by focusing on the few that I can change. But I got to learn enough from the few that I can change so that I can keep on changing and keep knocking down other dominoes. So I don't have to knock down all those dominoes, but, you know, when something doesn't go right or something doesn't work right, you know, I'll learn from that. So the next time I run into it, I can do it. But what are the glued down dominoes?
Yeah, I think that's
a good one.
I just thought of that one while we were talking. I'm like, oh, that's a good metaphor for what's happening here and that's what ends up essentially finding those is the problem for everybody. And you know that sometimes you're in a strand there where it's smooth sailing. It's like, great. But then if you want to do any work on like the vegans, you know, and you're like, that's important to me for some reason, or to the people that, you know, are sort of science food addicted where they just want their powdered food and their KFCs and, you know, Taco Bell. If I want to make some inroads over there, how do I do it? Then I think, you know, finding those points that are actually sticking you, not because it's not the whole thing. They agree with you on a lot. They always do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. Even in the, I mean, you use the vegan example. One of the things I tell people from the very beginning when we started Blue Mass Beef is I've really learned to appreciate vegan and vegetarian eaters. They're thoughtful, at least. I may not necessarily agree with their conclusion, but at least they're thinking through.
Absolutely.
Doing what they're doing. What I've come to really, you know, it's a glued down domino that frustrates me. And for now, it's not as important as what I call just, you know, cheap meat at any cost type folks. People that just, you know, give me my damn burger and I don't give a damn about anything else. Right.
Yeah.
I may not even say it that way, but I think that's a bigger barrier to transformation than thoughtful eaters. I think thoughtful eaters I can work with. I think people that fail to see and recognize the externalities, and you could probably translate that into any other field. I mean, we as humans are just not very good at appreciating externalities of any of our action, right? It's a hidden consequence. It's a second, third order variable.
Right.
It's an out of sight, out of mind, right? You know, even the stresses of the modern world, one of our coping mechanisms, certainly remember from psychology classes, denialism, right? You know, even if you can't let yourself admit that it's a problem because that will cause a crisis in you, right? So you therefore deny that it exists, it's a problem, and you go on about your merry life. Now give me the thoughtful leaders all day, every day, and then, you know, engage in ethical conversations, Dan, to discover the unglued dominoes or
there you go.
Glue soluble dominoes, whatever they
that's great. Well, it's been super fun, man. I appreciate it. I knew it'd be a good conversation.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. It's just I really didn't know what to expect, but it's a joy to talk to you. I know that it's always a fun time to chat with you, and this was fun.
Anything you want to tell people to go find Blue Nest Beef and buy better beef?
Yeah, they can find us at bluenestbeef.com. Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, won't claim to be very professional at any of those things right now. But if you go to our website, you get some great beef. And like I said, we just introduced a shelf stable beef stick. So that's easy access for anybody, anywhere, anytime. So try it out. Let us know what you think.
Yeah. And I definitely encourage you to. These guys, they're good guys. They're doing good stuff and they've got a good product. And plus it's got all this kind of moral import into it. Go out there, save the grassland birds, buy some better beef.
America's grassland birds, right?
That's right. America's Grassland Birds, AGBs.
AGB.
So, nice. Well, this has been awesome. I appreciate it. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Come back and see us soon. Get out there and persuade some people because they always need it.